from the trenches. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to From the Trenches, real life in the accounting industry. We are brought to you by BGL, Australia's number one corporate compliance superannuation software. I am David Boyer from SQL CFO. I'm joined here with Paul Meisner from Freedom Accounting System and Five Ways Group. Paul's been back in the country for a little bit longer now, caught up to date with all the news and views and excitement that is accounting. Paul, it's good to still have you back in Australia.
Welcome. I haven't quite settled into the cold weather yet, but good to be back. Good to be back playing golf. That's all I really missed.
They don't have golf
on the Greek islands? That's all I missed. No, there wasn't.
Too many nightclubs on the popular beach real estate.
Too much agriculture, not enough golf.
Right.
I thought it was pretty dry. It would have been a dry and dusty place. World of accounting, big as always. David,
huge.
Best on ground. What do you got for us?
A lot of interesting stuff. We're actually going to have a very deep show this week. The tax office has just been involved in a federal case that is amazing. Now, we all know that when the tax office sends out letters, you and I, Paul, we kind of treat that as gospel. The letter from the tax office is the one source of truth. On your desk in your office right now, you have a pile of written correspondence from the tax office.
Yep.
But what if a lot of that's automated? And what if no human has actually signed off or considered what's in those letters?
Which we know that they're automatically generated. It's assigned. Yeah, the signature's not really a signature. It's just, yep, it's authorised by, yep.
A case has gone to the federal court where it says on the liability that the taxpayer owed was 1.17, and they received a letter saying, we will accept a lump sum of 840 grand inclusive of estimated GIC.
Yep. Which remission of GIC, very common.
Very common. Very generous in this case. It's a lot of money. I don't know if that much is common. I think some people may not be too happy if that much was common. But is this valid? Now, the taxpayer relied on this letter, went out and got a loan from the bank, paid the tax office. The tax office then said, well, hang on, you asked the balance. And the taxpayer said, well, hang on, here's my letter where you said, because no human signed off on that letter, a court overruled it and said, well, no, Mr. Taxpayer, you can't rely on that. Paul, I'm putting this in best on ground because it's a fascinating case of automation gone too far. It's a case of this really bucks the trend of, I think, what we're expecting with automated correspondence and communication. But this is actually kind of a worst on ground because it really undermines faith in the tax system, doesn't it, if you can't rely on that letter you get from the tax office?
I think we see this often, which is common occurrences where the law doesn't keep up with technology. You know, and I think it's a bit harsh and a bit old world thinking to say that an organisation like the tax office that has a system with so much vetting and so much decision that you can't rely on, that sending out a letter isn't a decision because an individual hasn't touched it. I personally believe that enough individuals touched it. You know, clearly, I'm not a judge on the High Court or wherever it was. But for me, this case, when the ATO go back and try to unremit penalties, I think that's a bit harsh anyway.
Well, the ATO should fall on their sword on this one. The ATO officer said that he told the court he did not make a decision to remit the GIC, but he caused the letter to issue, but he couldn't explain how that sentence came to be on the letter because the computer put it there.
This is if the letter spits out, if something goes out on your letterhead, you know, imagine a normal business, not that the ATO is not a normal business.
No,
a normal business, you have an old copy of a contract that happens to have, you've got it off the internet, where it's got a clause that you never intended it to be. If you go to court and your client has a signed contract, you know, what can you now say? Oh, Word wasn't a, you know, it was a template system.
Yeah.
I never touched it.
Well,
dangerous precedent.
Well, I didn't put that in there. The little paperclip popped up and said, I see you're writing a letter.
The paperclip.
It was the paperclip law.
I want to see the paperclip case.
Yes.
David Boyer, taxpayer versus Microsoft paperclip.
And I want them to appear in court in a paperclip costume. My other best.
I want a subpoena. Was it subpoena or you
subpoena?
Know, subpoena the paperclip.
Yes. Yeah. It looks like you're running a court case.
Exactly. Anyway, but very interesting that a standard letter isn't considered.
Really interesting.
Which sounds a bit silly to me. David, keep going.
Inspector General of Taxation has called for oversight of the ATO to be improved, basically giving it its own government department. Amid concerns power is too concentrated at the top of the ATO. This follows the long story arc that started a couple of months ago with that big Four Corners and Fairfax investigation into taxpayers. That's right, investigation, inverted commas, into taxpayers who had had collections services issued against them. To me, Paul, we said that the ATO doesn't need more oversight, it just adds more government. We don't necessarily want that. We just want the ATO to use its powers properly as it goes through its large digital transformation project. For me, this feels like we've got an election in November-ish. We've got an election sometime soon.
But the Inspector General doesn't have an election.
Been politicised. Anything that gets this much media attention gets politicised. I'm reading between lines here. I think that this is a topic that a politician could jump on and say, I'm going to make sure the tax office doesn't come out and get you.
David, you and I, we've covered this...
Maybe I'm too cynical.
...story quite a lot. No, never. Hey, that's my job.
Yeah.
you can have it for a minute. Oversight of the ATO, it is really an interesting one where someone's got to have the power. And I think, in my experience, and a lot of agents... You know, it's interesting, the more and more agents I speak to, the more stories that interest me, that are almost somewhat changing my opinion. You know, I've always, in my experience, and those sort of that I'd historically spoken to, have always considered it quite fair. So... I am hearing some stories and sort of seeing some stories where it gets a little bit beyond. I personally feel like there are avenues to escalate. I may be slightly more connected potentially, but you know, I think oversight is interesting because that's what the Inspector General was there for. Like, effectively, if an independent Inspector General of Taxation who is there now, they didn't have the power to have appeals and everything else. You know, I don't see oversight working in an efficient manner.
The call is to move it from currently reports to the Treasury portfolio and actually having it report direct to Parliament to increase its independence.
Interesting. Oh, look, I let's see what we, you know, interesting what the listeners hear. I don't see the need for it, but it's interesting. Outgoing Inspector General of Taxation putting up a nice hospital pass for the next person.
Yeah, definitely. You're right. You know why? I think it's because you and I have met some of the tax office commissioners and we know that the intention is to do the right thing. It's just a massive organisation. It's a government organisation going through massive digital transformation. And some unfortunate things sometimes happen. You can say that's not good enough, but, you know, yep. I think that's what happens.
Anyway, interesting.
What about you, mate?
Very, very interesting. Something I bought back from my holiday, David. Best on ground. So I was sitting in cafes in Naxos, do a bit of restaurant eating. And one thing I noticed, particularly on this Greek island of Naxos, was every single cafe restaurant, all of their servers had, when you took their order, they had a mobile phone. And they basically had their point of sale system or their ordering software, all your invoices, everything else, they had on their iPhone. So they keyed it in, didn't matter which staff. It was amazing. And I eat out a little bit in Melbourne, never seen it in Melbourne. You know, you see point of sale systems at the cash register or behind the counter, your server will go back to their spot and they'll key it into an iPad. Obviously, at a cafe, you've got those iPads on the stands that someone's... I've never seen it on a mobile phone. So I inquired, being inquisitive, apparently built by a computer shop on the island of Naxos, no mess, no fuss, no marketing T-shirts, no road shows, no marketing teams... No, you know...
No after parties.
No death of Saganaki. This was just this was just software that was... Anyway, it was amazing because There was none of this servers go, oh, wait, I'll get a pen. No, you know, no, no, trust me. I'll remember your, you know, your order for a table
and
of
16
10,
variations and off then, the standard
exactly,
menu.
Exactly, yeah, no worries. Or if you, but my best was you'd, if you'd forgotten. So at this stage, I will paint a picture that I was sitting on a sun lounge on the beach at a beachside taverna and inquired
taverna.
As to...
Not a tavern?
I think taverna. Just getting into the
you're
island.
You're getting
line.
A local.
No, but anyway, but if you'd forgotten an order, they didn't have to run, the server didn't continually have to run back. And the beauty of it, some of these seats were across the road from the from the actual kitchen.
Yeah.
So efficiency of service, it was amazing. Anyway, it was really good to see... and I want we want some in Australia, please, because I'm sick of bad service here.
There's probably a lot of add-ons falling over themselves, saying, oh, we do that, we tried to do that, we tried to do that, all these sort of... I like it because it's a local idea. That's what I like about that one, Paul.
They
just
do
solves
it.
A problem they have on the and island
it,
of Naxos.
And it works. And some of them even had the sort of the bum bag with the change in it, and on their belt was one of those printers... So basically, they didn't have, this wasn't, you know, oh, can we get the bill? Yeah, sure, half an hour later. This was, all right, press a button on their phone, the receipt comes out of their...
Can they take payment out on the phone? Belt. Like Square or something like that? To take, where'd you pay?
If you were paying on card, they brought over the mobile, you know, the normal...
But that's the beauty of what you're talking about. Terminal. It just did one thing and it did it exceptionally
well. Yeah, they didn't then have Stripe...
Not fully integrated.
It was just... And presumably, you know, it was any phone they had. Anyway, very interesting. Kudos to the island of Naxos.
Well done, Naxos.
But that one was great. Great. So does that make my Saganaki's tax deductible now that I've brought it back? That was a tax joke for those playing along.
Any accounting you want to talk about, Paul?
No. Right, next best on ground. BGL, Ron Leash, unleashed.
Our mate, Ron.
Unleashed. He got unleashed. A week or two ago, BGL disturbed by comments on accountants exemption by CAANZ tax lead. Ron Leash, absolute advocate for the accountants exemption, for getting rid of this licensing mess that we find ourselves in, questioning whether CA and CPA did enough, and in a way... just questioned whether or not the CA tax lead was working for the government or working for members. Basically, Michael Croker, the tax lead, had said at a conference that there was sort of no way that the exemption was coming back. And Ron was sort of saying, if you're not helping, you know, try to help members, your members, rather than just throwing your hands up and claiming it's all too hard. Look... I have spoken to CANZ, you know, the work they're doing is deeper than one quote that was taken from a presentation, but I see both sides in terms of the work they're doing, but also the work they're not doing.
I love Ron's ability to pick a specific issue, a specific topic, and actually just drive the nail through it and say, here's where the problem lies, here's what needs to be done about it. The accountant's exemption is everywhere. It hasn't affected me, my business. It doesn't affect you too much, Paul, but I think a lot of people up in arms about it. I know our mates at Accountants Daily, it's one of the hottest topics that does, I guess, lots of clicks for them, I believe. And it's great to have people standing up. I mean, that's what this show's about, Paul. We want people putting a voice up there, making the change that we need, and it's right to consistently question whether our industry bodies are acting in members' interests.
I don't think they are. I don't think they are enough. I think, especially I've been very public in my criticism of CA saying that they are heavily corporate and not almost in any way, I think, member-focused, but that's, you know, probably a personal opinion rather than a professional one. And I want to reinstate the call. There was back in the day a joint accounting body. It was an occasional meeting between the three accounting bodies.
The JAG.
The JAG, the joint accounting group. Where I'm putting out a from
JAG,
the trenches call for those three to get back in a room, get the bodies, if there's not to merge, not to do any of that stuff, just get back in the room. Pick a cause that actually matters to all of the members and, you know, the weight of numbers of all of you together, stand up for us and don't leave it to small podcasts and BGL to do it for you.
I love it, Paul. Let's get it back. It's the JAB, the Joint Accounting Bodies, CPA Institute of Chartered Accountants.
JAG was a better thing than JAB.
We want them to give a bit of a jab, get something done, and the IPA. Paul's spitting up his soda stream through his nose. Give him a jab, Paul.
Absolutely.
What else you got? We got anything else?
That was it. Best on Greg. You're on worst. Go on.
We're up to worst.
What got your goat this week?
Can't remember. I'm settled down after our imagining you relaxing.
I'll
the
just
Greek
read
Islands.
Off the spreadsheet since you don't have it in front of you. The CPE problems.
Paul, I tell you what. You do. I think you exemplify the worst of this. You regularly say, but David, we accountants, we know what we do. We know our value. We know what we're good at. 25% of accountants out of a sample size of 1,000 by the Tax Practitioner Board failed their CPE requirements. Now, admittedly, 21% were like just fails, near enough. They kind of got little warnings. And only 4% actually failed. But in the area of compliance, Paul, I don't think near enough is a good enough standard, especially for a professional group of people. The reason why this is bad and why I want to point it out, you did some brilliant work with the tax office and found out that 50% of work-related expense claims are wrong,
yep,
that are prepared by tax agents.
Yep.
So you have 25%, a quarter of us failing our continual education requirements, half of us getting a really basic deduction wrong. If you want a sign that the standard of our professional service is dropping, that's it right there. And I think we have a way too casual approach to CPE, and I'd be one of them as well. You know, all of us don't really... You want an app out there, make CPE recording easy, like really, really easy. I don't think I record it well enough. I reckon I do my hours just. I'll probably scrape it together. But I think... In general, we need to up our ante on what we do on our CPA. Maybe we just take it a bit more seriously.
For sure. I think that CPA is a big issue. There are no clear guidelines. The understanding of what counts and what doesn't,
yep,
count is murky at best. You know, I think people, I would like to think, some people fail just from not knowing. Look, that look says it all. Look, I think we're an aging profession, and there are some. We both have fathers that are, you know, that end. Luckily, they don't listen. Well, mine doesn't. They would sit there and go, "I have done this job forever. I am not sitting in a room and listening to some 20-something-year-old marketing expert tell me how to do my job," which I fully take. But they also don't, you know, generally take tax training either. There is a lot. I think there is still a lot to be said for on the job training. I worry about the educational requirements for the people who aren't doing returns day in, day out.
If I didn't know that half of all work-related expenses were wrong, then you could run that argument. But even if it is, whatever the training, it's not. The point is to get compliance right, is to be compliant. Irrespective of what the educational regime is, there wouldn't be an accountant out there who wants to do the wrong thing, yet they are. So it's not, whatever's happening isn't working. You just shouldn't have
but
that
this
mistake.
This is just, over a quarter of tax agents, but that's how many failed on, you know, more on record keeping grounds than anything else. 4% were truly non-compliant.
Paul, if you fail on record-keeping grounds, it means because you don't have records, because you didn't do it, and you're scraping around the hours to get through the audit. We all
I see
know
the best in people,
that.
You know,
all right.
I see the best in people. Anyway, do you know what annoys me? And this is another swipe at the professional bodies. It takes the ATO and the TPB to finally get around to this, whereas the professional bodies have been crowing for years about the strength of their CPE program and how important have they ever done a proper CPE audit on their members?
It is strong, Paul. They sit there looking at the P&L of their education division. They say, "Oh, wow, this is strong. This is doing quite well for us. Well done. Bravo, everybody. We've made a lot of money off education this year. Success." Meanwhile, people can't get work-related expenses right.
That is a massive issue. Don't get me wrong. I think everyone should do every tax practitioner should do work-related expense training.
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
But look, I think...
Actually, every business owner should do it as well. Mass education of
true,
the country.
True. Just more in the myth-busting We've actually spoken to the ATO about some podcasts, maybe.
Can we do a Mythbusters with the ATO?
I'm trying.
Got the buck. I'll be the guy with the stash. I'll just shave the beard out a bit.
They don't talk anymore, though, those two, apparently.
Really? Brogus.
Hate each other. Over-quarter to anyone. Look, I think it's focusing on the wrong thing. I think a very small percentage are absolutely non-compliant, the 25%. But congratulations to the 71 who comply.
Oh, yeah, well done, guys. You did the minimum requirement. Bravo. on to marketing, worst on ground.
You are a hard
worst
man.
On ground for marketing. A post on LinkedIn caught my attention. Jamie Hallett is a marketing and growth consultant for the professional services sectors. Says, I hate seeing accountants getting criticised for their marketing when so many of them are duped into signing up to ridiculous marketing packages by greedy, lazy companies. Paul, we comment regularly that we think marketing companies are unaccountable and lazy. What this person's done is, where's the quote, Paul? Where's the quote that I need? On Friday, 45 firms in the US who I follow on Twitter posted exactly the same cartoon. It's come from one marketing company that charges $99 a month to do standard website, email hosting, email marketing, blog post, the whole shebang for $99 a month, and they're all posting exactly the same thing. I'll tell you why this is so bad. I think that firms are very unique, and every firm's a little bit different, and it's all based on the personality of the practitioner that's running it. And I'm going to refer to our mate Andrew van der Beek, who talks very openly and really from the heart about how important it is to find out who you are, be true to yourself, and make that express through your firm. If you're just using standard marketing and outsourcing your entire brand and your entire image, you're not anything to anyone. You're running the path to commoditization. And that will start to come down in your prices, because the consumer sits there and says, well, what's the difference between these guys? Now, when BOMA launched at Xerocon last year, we both said, this isn't going to work. Why would every firm want to be exactly the same? And BOMA was from the main stage last year to the back of the hall with two people on a little stand this year at Xerocon. Marketing needs to be personalised. You need to express who you are. And, Paul, I know you don't like marketing, but, geez, your five-way site, I know exactly who Paul Meisner is by jumping on that site.
Thank you very much. I agree with the website. I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to play devil's advocate on this for a second and say that, website aside, I think if you have exactly the same website as everyone else, that is a message, that is a recipe for disaster. With this sharing content stuff, I'm all for bespoke content, but let's be honest, it takes you and I a lot of time to create our own bespoke content.
The good stuff. Yeah.
You know, and look, I really feel for small practitioners who they get yelled at by so-called marketing for accounting experts that they have to write 6 blogs, 38 LinkedIn posts, 752 tweets. You know, so they are, and get sold this package. My other point, though, you know, so they're being told they have to do it, and when they do it, they're being clipped around. The other thing I have to say, though, is marketing is all about your target market. Now, if your target market, clearly this person, you know, they are a marketing and growth consultant for accountancy. So, of course, he's following multiple accounting firms. What client? You know, so for that firm, the clients that might be searching you or finding your feed, the content might still resonate because they don't have the perspective of every other firm. I still don't believe, and other people, people may disagree, but I had this conversation with Lillette. I don't know whether I'm allowed to say that we were having this conversation, but talking about whether or not people who have come through referrals, I don't, in recollection, 8 or 9 years, have recollection where I've had somebody come to me and gone, you know, I've been checking out multiple accounting firms and I've done all of the research on all of them and I'm ringing you and I'm ringing...
That's happening. I reckon it's happening.
No, but I haven't seen it, right? In the small end.
Me and Andrew van der Beek ended up pitching for the same client very recently. We found out through chatting, how's your pipeline?
In terms of small compliance, I don't see it. So therefore, if they see this content, the chances are that person who that marketing is designed to resonate with hasn't seen the other 43 firms use it. Potentially. Obviously, someone is looking at a global view. So I actually still don't see as much the problem, as much as I hate template marketing.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. But I think when I think that marketing is the thing that helps people realise your value, whether it's through a referral, it's the way somebody has spoken about you gets the referral in, and I just think this leads to the path of commoditisation. Also, remember, America's a much bigger market than here, so if you've got 45 doing the same thing here...
How does this lead to commoditisation?
Because the market perceives what your brand's worth based on the experience that they see out in the marketplace.
But aren't the clients who arguably the clients who follow just that firm, because they're just firms of that clients, aren't they getting a better experience because they're getting more content from their already...
Not if the firm is different to the standard marketing that's going out there. That is where you get
they
a disconnect.
They don't see it, though.
No, but you could. So 45 firms have gone out, and what they've put out there is... Well, I think it's a very crappy joke. It's a cartoon, right? If you call that firm, you get in touch with that firm. Let's just say the marketing works and it creates an inquiry, right? And the firm's nothing like what's been put out there. This is a commoditisation.
Yeah, okay.
This is where standard marketing breaks.
I understand.
You and I spend a lot of time on our websites to make sure what we are is what you see.
Question without notice. Yeah. Are you saying that they shouldn't have posted anything? Are you saying it's better to be inactive on social media rather than...
Yeah.
If creating your own bespoke content, which for a lot of these firms is off the table, what's your take?
I'll give you an example that I saw this morning as a take. There's a firm in Melbourne called The Practice, really cool firm. They do very little on social media. I saw it this morning. They had Trendiness talk to an event that they hosted this morning. So I saw it on Twitter. They've only got like 300 Twitter followers. As a firm, I think Jason, one of the practitioners, probably has a lot more, but they're clearly not investing a huge amount in social. This is a fast-growing, great firm. They've got multiple divisions. They've obviously decided that social isn't part of their strategy. They're going to do it through other marketing channels, which clearly include events. So, no, you don't have to be on socials, but you need to have a conversation about what are we going to do to present ourselves to the community. And I'm a huge fan of accountants putting themselves out there and putting their value into the community so people know what they do. I think that's very, very good for Australian society. So I think you should do something, even if it's as little as what Boyer Partners, my dad's firm, does. Right at the front, when you drive down Glen Huntly Road, South Caulfield, there's this massive CA sign, the old one, the red one. I probably shouldn't
never
say that.
Never going to change. No.
But that's it, and that's what he is. He is that steady, trusted hand. That's the brand of it.
He doesn't want to tweet? He doesn't. For $99, he can get standard tweets. Anyway, that was a joke.
My dad on Twitter. I think he follows SEN on Twitter. That's about it.
Fair enough, too. Right, my worst on ground, because we've got to keep moving. That nearly turned into a bit longer than we need.
I'll thank Wayne Schmidt for bringing that article to my attention.
Well done. Right, worst on ground for me, accountancy age. So this is out of, and I just want to double check, this is out of the UK. Pretty sure it's out of the UK. I'm going to say it's out of the UK.
Well, given that's your... That's the crescendo of your argument here, I hope it
is. Well, basically, I mean, it doesn't matter, any market. An outline of cloud accounting software. Now, how does cloud accounting differ from more traditional accounting systems? Now, I did have to double check, because there's, you know, there is a trick in marketing where you go and, you know, repost an old blog consistently and forever and ever and ever. But I did have to look. This was actually published on October the 5th of 2018, not 2012. Chris Hooper actually posted on this, saying, is this a joke? For me, it's a very good article. It's kind of the same article that I think in Australia we were using potentially 8 years ago. Talks about security, talks about traditional accounting systems. Is it safe? You know, so anyway, I just thought that I'd put it out there. We hear a lot out of the UK, business coaches for accountants telling us how good the UK market is and how innovative. Well, you know, one of their main publications is still sort of running articles like that. I think that is that was very interesting for me, David. They're still having those conversations over there.
Well, I think that everyone's on a different stage of their cloud journey, Paul. And this is one thing, my big takeaway from my Partner Connect. And if you are right at the start, if you are that late majority that we spoke about in last week's show, maybe this is the content that's needed. For you and I, it's a snooze fest. And probably for anyone listening, it's a snooze fest. But
I actually thought, I mean, if you are very early on your journey, and I do take that into account, David, but the way most of the marketing talks for most of these publications is all about what's going to happen in the future,
yeah.
Not... you know, not these let's help the slow ones. It's all about let's berate the slow ones for not being as quick as the fast ones. Anyway, next one, workandmoney.com did a, in the career section, 25 dying professions you should avoid.
You'll never guess who's on the list, will you, dear listener?
So this was just, but this was interesting for me. So in the blurb, it said, you know, routine jobs, the author of some book, Robots Are Coming. So your accountant may not have a job in the future, but plastic surgeons and emergency room doctors should do well, was in their blurb. Then you click in and you list the professions, and the only profession close was bookkeepers. So this again comes to me, and bookkeepers came in number 3 of 25. Again, this concept where the market and some of these reports cannot differentiate the role of an accountant or a bookkeeper for that matter, because I personally believe that bookkeepers do a lot more than data entry. Thinking that accounting and bookkeeping is data transposition.
Yes.
Thinking that, not, again, not the time they spend, but the value they create coming from data transposition, which it isn't, it's adding value to business. So in the article, they've just thrown in, my iPad just collapsed. They've thrown in the word accountant just, you know, for fun. But then in the list, it's actually bookkeeper. I still think they're wrong, or they're again mischaracterizing the tasks of a bookkeeper. But anyway, it's interesting. We see these articles all the time, David.
Yes, and this article seems to keep rearing its head. I saw this on Twitter last month, actually. A few people were commenting on this one. But it is. I mean, you and I are sick of accounting just getting lumped on the end of that. Accounting and bookkeeping, as if it's exactly the same thing. But there was also an article that came out this week saying that millennials are still looking for careers in accounting. So which one is it, guys? For all your protesting they shouldn't do it, they clearly still want it, because the accounting that we know, which is client-facing, which is using your smarts, which is being creative to solve problems, is still an attractive career path for young people, which is good for us.
It absolutely is. Absolutely. Right, that was best and worst on ground. Moving on to the in-depth topic this week. David, I've had enough time to get the feet back under the desk and, you know, pump out some work and get the kids and the family over the jet lag. I thought what I would do is do a little recap on my pros and cons of my second and potentially last for a while remote working trip.
Calling it early,
but with the kids getting older, the oldest Harry heading to school next year, probably not going to get the opportunity to do the same thing. I want to give my three pros and my three cons for the remote working trip. The first pro was that the technology worked. I think that in this day and age, we can take that as a given. The ability to have a local SIM that travelled all around Europe, the online accounting, the online everything else, I don't need to go into the technology. That clearly still worked, whether it was on a beach, mobile. It was great. Anyway, found that really good. So that was a tick. The cons, I don't want to blame the kids, because it certainly wasn't their fault. But having kids that were older, mine are 2.5 now and 5, older, a little bit more demanding is not the wrong word. They need
active,
exactly, active and attentive. They don't sleep as much. 2 years ago, when we did it the first time, we had a 3-year-old and a baby. A lot more sleep, daytime naps, getting into bed earlier. I think one of the problems was we started in Spain and they don't eat dinner till 11 o'clock at night in Spain. So there was sort of absolutely no time to then go back and do work. It really did limit the ability to work. So, you know, remote working with kids, especially kids that are in that sort of early school or whatever, before they're old enough to be truly independent. And so we've probably put remote working to this extent on hold till the kids can actually fend for themselves, you know, get their own breakfast, get their own stuff, and largely keep themselves occupied, which a 2.5 and a 5-year-old can't. Second pro, the clients don't care. This is something that I guess just astounds me every time, or the two times that I've done it, is that clients, some of them are unaware, some of them find out, but none of them sort of say, oh, that's an issue. You know, you get back on time, you're still communicative, you still try to be as attentive as possible. You know, look, if those service standards do drop because there were periods of limited activity or limited connectivity, that they still have the same problems, but that's no different in your, if you're here and but your service
do
drops.
Do you have your client profile, do you have clients that would have something that's urgent, or they're largely like steady family businesses, aren't they? Like, so that
I had a few things that I had a few
like
things
wait 24
were,
hours. I mean,
yeah,
like, not
exactly.
Much.
No, there's not. You don't get a drop in the, you know, the world's on fire kind of thing. It was kind of funny because having Nick here, it arguably we'll talk about time zones in a sec, but it sort of extended the period. You know, if Nick wasn't available because Melbourne had left work, I was still up later. So sort of in a way it extended, and we'll talk about time zones in a sec. I think, look, clients, they were really understanding, and they were almost jealous, which they were sort of again 2 years ago. It wasn't as great an experience for them or for me to not be able to sort of be there with them or have more contact hours. But apart from that, you know, the clients were really supportive.
Was there an impact on Nick? Because I saw him a few times here at the office and
you came and hot desked off my desk.
I did once. I recorded a show from there. Oh, I did. Okay. I kicked him out and I did it.
He said that you were louder than me.
Really?
Yep. He said you talk louder. Anyway.
Is that a compliment?
I don't know. For me it was, probably. Look, he...
But there's a show voice. We have a show voice that we put on.
True. No, that's my normal phone voice. I get excited. I think for Nick... So Nick's had a period where he's also been remote working in China. So for the month before I was away for 7 weeks, he was away for a month.
Yeah.
Remote working. I've come back, and in I think another month and a half, he'll go away for another 3 or 4 weeks, and then I'm away again for a month. So I think remote working clearly works on the client side. Where it doesn't work, so that my next con is the time zone. Europe is just so hard to do business with Australia. I found it really hard to get up and sort of get up and get moving in the morning. Don't know whether that's because I've hit the big 4-0 or the kids. But, you know, really by the time 7 a.m. was 2 p.m. or 3 p.m., depending on whether I was in Spain or Greece, daylight saving kicked in at the end, which helped. But I think when you've only really got from 3 p.m. till 6 p.m. or 3 p.m. till 5 p.m. to do all of your contact hours,
not much.
And then Melbourne winds down and you can do some other work, but largely there's no pressure on. So you kind of go, oh, well, the kids are playing on the beach, I'm going to go there. And then you couple that with the fact that, you know, the kids sort of didn't then go back to sleep where you could get back to work.
Would you say that you have a lifestyle business?
The last 7 weeks, I certainly did. Look, I know I certainly turned it into a holiday, which is my next pro, but... Yeah. And I was just going to say that my next pro was that the family game. You know, this was probably, if you were going to weigh it, at one end was, you know, remote working on the working end, and one was sort of family holiday, sitting on a beach eating souvlaki and drinking beer. Well, this was clearly, whereas 2 years ago, I worked hard. You know, two years ago, there was a lot on. I was diligent about it. I got up and I was gone. Like, I did not see the kids from sort of 6 a.m. till midday or 1 p.m., five days a week, whereas this time I was sort of working a bit more on my phone around the kids or
so
whatever.
If you're listening and you're a client of Five Ways Group, sorry we couldn't get back to you. We were eating suvas and drinking beers.
Pretty much.
And they were playing with the kids.
And they were yum, absolutely yum. And so, look, and so I guess that's, you know, that's the seesaw that I found this time compared to last. You know, the family really gained, and I think anyone who has kids... you know, and who has travelled with them, and certainly some people have shared their stories with me while I was away and since I've been back. You know, and so the flip side of that was probably the business lost a bit. You know, I didn't get enough hours, you know, probably work done as I needed to, which not so much, you know, nothing sort of dropped, but it leaves a lag for now.
Yeah.
Now that I'm back. Anyway, It was hard. So I guess off the back of that, my perfect trip probably is no kids, a better, more friendly time zone, and you pretty much got it nailed.
That's it. Oh, and also spent 5 years building 100% cloud-based practice with all the systems and all the technology and clients who understand the way that you work. That's the other
thing. Apart from that, yeah, you've got to do some pre-work went into it, probably, in terms of the systems, maybe.
Look, I think I found, you know, I remote work a bit differently to you. I go up to Queensland quite a lot because we've got family up there and it's just beautiful to be...
You're a remote worker as well.
So we do it quite a bit. And increasingly, I can see with my daughter, it's harder to work when she's in the room. I can see that already. Like at home, I'm much less productive than I used to be. So we'll see how that pans out. We're planning to go up to Queensland for a while in summer this year. So I'm actually thinking I might try to find some office space to get some work done because the kids are a positive distraction.
Mate, back to co-working.
Yeah.
Coming back.
Well, mate, no, I'm still here a bit. But, mate, that's about it for this week's show. Countech Live coming up.
Wakoa coming up.
Off to Singapore for the... I'm talking in Singapore this week on what can only be described as...
a junket.
Oh, you said it, mate. we're giving three talks, though, mate. It's bloody hard work, three talks.
In Singapore.
I hate talking.
Mini violin out.
But of course, Aussie contingent there. I'm going to be there. Let's going to be there. Wayne's coming down from wherever in the world he's living at the moment. Matty Paff's going to be there. A few other Aussies as well. Kev Fitzgerald, who used to be was he your account manager? He's now running Zero Southeast Asia. Zero's all over. This one's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you've got anything, if you want us to talk about anything, let us know and we'll cover it on the show. Apart from that, have a great week.
See you guys.
Thanks again for listening to an episode of From the Trenches. David and I love to hear from listeners, so you can reach out if you've got feedback or story ideas. Get in touch. I can be reached on Twitter at @PaulMeissner_ or on LinkedIn, Paul Meissner.
I'm on Twitter at David Boyar, Boyar, on LinkedIn, David Boyar.
From the Trenches.